thank you also for the invitation. This is the second and maybe the last talk today about fluid dynamics. It will be a flow that's in some sense more complicated than the previous one, because I'm going to go to much higher Reynolds number. But in another sense, it's going to be simpler, I suppose. The geometry is going to be simpler. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is, before I move on, I have to mention, this is all work with Kenta Kawahara, and Matsumura Atsushi is his student, his grad student. Genta is a physicist, and he's interested in shear flows. So I'm going to talk about a very simple model of shear flow, which is called plane couette flow. And I'm going to talk about a relatively new approach to the open problems in plane couette flow that's based on the dynamical systems theory. And I'm also going to explain, or it's going to be apparent halfway through my talk, why this is a relatively new approach and why we can do this now when we couldn't 15 years ago. So I'm not going to assume any prior knowledge about turbulence, so let me just explain roughly what the plane couette flow is. Okay, so plane couette flow is a wall and a second wall. They are parallel and infinite, and they're moving in opposite direction. And there's a fluid viscous but incompressible fluid trapped in between the two walls. Okay, so just like in the previous talk, we imposed no-slip boundary conditions. So what's happening in this flow is that the linear momentum is forced to be in this direction at the top and in this direction at the bottom. So there's an imbalance in the linear momentum, which is normally conserved quantity, so there's some tension there. And the way this tends to be resolved by Mother Nature is to form kind of convective rolls. So this is very similar to heat convection, but it's convection of linear momentum. And in this picture, that's been colored. So this is what you see here is the mid plane, and the little arrows that are a bit hard to see are the fluid velocity. And the red here is linear momentum directed with the top wall, and the blue is the linear momentum directed with the bottom wall. Okay, so you can see that where we have convective rolls, that's counter-rotating rolls, a bit of fluid here is advected upward and here it's advected downward, so there's some mixing going on. Okay, so this is sort of a random snapshot of a numerical simulation done by John Gibson. This is all, by the way, if you're so interested after this talk that you want to do this, you can actually go to this website and you can download the entire software for simulating the fluid for free. You can even download the software for computing special solutions for free. So anybody can do this now. You don't have to spend 5 years on computing or programming a pseudo-spectral integration code. Okay, so what is so interesting about couette flow? Well, it's the following problem. In flows like flows along a rotating cylinder or heat convection or rotating flows, there is a linear instability. So we know there is a forcing parameter, which might be a rotation rate or a differential heating or something like that. And if it is very small, the flow is smooth, and we call it a laminar flow. And if it gets larger, we go through a series of instabilities that we can classify as bifurcations, and we can shoot our guns at it, and we can basically understand what's going on. This doesn't work in plane couette flow, strangely enough. So if the velocity of the walls is very, very slow, then we have a laminar solution. So the velocity is always in the plane, okay, and all the planes are just parallel. Then if we increase the speed of the walls, so we increase the Reynolds number, in a numerical experiment or in the laboratory, we start to see stuff like this happening spontaneously. And if we then go to our desks and we take out our pencil and we do the linear stability analysis, we find that there's no linear stability. No, nothing. Okay, so the laminar solution is linearly stable for all Reynolds numbers. So if the walls move with the velocity of light, speed of light, okay, there's still a stable laminar solution. So these solutions that we find in actual experiments or in numerical experiments, they come out from somewhere else. Okay? And we still don't know exactly what's happening there. And that also means that we have no well-defined Reynolds number at which we can say there is a transition to turbulence. We cannot say at Reynolds number 400 there's transition to turbulence, or 25 times pi over, you know, the square root of the log of 2. It just doesn't exist. And in laboratory experiments, it depends really on how careful you do the experiment and how well it's set up, at what Reynolds number you start to see irregularities happen. So this is called the subcritical transition because there's no criticality. And well, many ideas have been launched to try and solve this. One of the ideas is very natural for the crowds like we have today. It's saying, well, we have an equilibrium state, but the equilibrium state has only a finite domain of attraction. As the Reynolds number goes up, the domain of attraction shrinks. Okay, so it's very natural. And then if you are in this laminar flow, a very tiny perturbation will take you out of the domain of attraction and you're gone. And what happens next, nobody knows, because that's fully nonlinear. Okay? So that's half the answer. But the other half of the answer, there's nobody who knows it. The other half of the answer would be to explain what is all this turbulent motion, where does it come from, and so forth, and what is the physics behind it. So a very important step forward was taken by Kawahara and Kira, so it's the same Kawahara. And many other people jumped on this topic after that. What they did is, okay, they said, we know a lot about chaos, we know about periodic orbit theory, and we know about bifurcations. Why don't we just try to take that machinery and use it in this turbulence, the analysis of turbulence flows? And the difficulty there is that these turbulence flows, these simulations that I can show you, maybe while I'm explaining this, I can show you a little movie of what it might look like. So this, for instance, is a simulation of Couette flow. This is the picture we're just looking at. So this is the bottom wall and the top wall. This is the mid-plane, and these are different quantities in the mid-plane. So if you want to simulate this, this is solving a gigantic set of ODEs. Okay, maybe 20,000 or 100,000 or however many you can cram into your computer. So basically, you have a bunch of ODEs with parameters. So why not use bifurcation theory? Well, because every software that we had for doing bifurcation theory assumes that you have maybe 10 equations for three or something like that, and not 100,000. So it was very brave of them to just jump in at the deep end and try to actually solve this with direct methods. So this is a very naive method they used here. So what is shown here, they were looking for time periodic solutions because they know that these are very special in the theory of chaos. And they found two of them. They are shown here in the projection. There's energy input rate and energy dissipation rate. Okay, so there's dissipation because there's viscosity, and there's input because of the no-slip boundary conditions. So this is projection from a very, very high-dimensional phase space. And these curves, so there's one special curve here. This is a closed curve, and there's another one that's sort of a clover leaf. Okay, and they're both closed curves, so they're time periodic solutions to the Navier-Stokes equation, or at least to a discretization of the Navier-Stokes equation. And what was so important about their find? Well, there's two of them. This guy lives in a very turbulent region. So if you look at the velocity fields on points along this orbit, it's very much like the turbulent velocity fields we saw in the random integration. But if you look over here, you see a very gentle variation of the laminar flow. It's not turbulent at all. The input rate and dissipation rate is very small, and it is a very gentle solution. Okay, and then I hypothesized that maybe there exist heteroclinic connections between these two orbits that explain how in a flow that is apparently stable, or that's linearly stable, or the laminar flow is linearly stable, if you are kicked out of this domain of attraction of the laminar stage, you might come close to this guy here. This guy is not stable. It's just unstable in stable directions. And then you're transported and you go into turbulence, and maybe you go back for a while and you see all this complicated behavior. Nice. So that would be the first time that somebody actually set up sort of a skeleton, okay, made out of components that are special solutions from well-known dynamical systems theory to explain the turbulence that we see in the shear flow. Okay. It's a very bold step forward. And we now know, yes. So the axis here is energy input rate, and this is the energy input rate. And this is normalized by its value in the laminar flow. So this guy lives, the energy input rate in this orbit on average is about twice that of the laminar flow. And this is energy dissipation rate. Yeah, so these are the same. The only difference between these pictures is that this orbit here is an orbit that was started in unstable manifold of this guy here. And then there's another one that started in the unstable manifold of that guy here. Because they wanted to argue that there are connections between the two. And these blue dots are just a very long turbulent integration. It gives you a bit of an idea of, say, the probability density function in turbulent motion or so. That's a bit iffy. But these I've taken from their original paper. And So this, they just very boldly put in some paper in the journal Fluid Mechanics, and it said, so there are heteroclinal connections between these two periodic orbits. And that was published, and it was very excited. And now we know that that was wrong. Okay, so we can, you know, people will know a little bit about global bifurcations in the audience. You know that if you can, if you know the spectrum of this guy here and the spectrum of this guy here, you can compute the codimension of having an actual heteroclinal connection between the two. And if it's higher than zero, then you're dead. Yeah, because then you would need to tune more than at least one parameter to see it. And they didn't tune any parameter at all. These parameters have been chosen from completely different reasons. Okay, so we know it was wrong, but the idea is probably correct. And people started to look for special solutions to this kind of flow. And this configuration with solutions like this was consecutively found in different geometries, in pipes, in ducts, so that's like a pipe with square angles, in Poiseuille flow with walls that are not moving but there's pressure forcing. So in all sorts of different geometries and different numerical techniques, we started to find the same sort of dynamical layout. So we now believe that this is really robust. And the super special thing about this configuration here is that this orbit has a single unstable multiplier. So this is a bit weird, right? Because you have 15,000 dimensions in this case for the simulation. The 15,000 multipliers, okay, 14,999 are inside the unit circle. Well, 98. One is on the unit circle, trivial, and one is outside. So that looks like a fluke, right? But then we start to find the same thing also in pipes and also in ducts. Okay, so to wrap up the introduction, this is the dynamical picture that I want to talk about. The idea then emerged that the following is the case. We have in our phase space, so this is a representation of our phase space that's theoretically infinite dimensional, but in practice it will be just a very large discrete dimension. We have the laminar flow, which is just an equilibrium point. It's linearly stable. We have turbulence. We don't really know what's going on here. There's probably infinitely many periodic solutions or so. And we have one of these very special quiescent periodic orbits. So there are very gentle variation of the laminar flow that have an unstable manifold that's two-dimensional, okay? One unstable and one neutral direction. And that means that the stable dimension is separating this space. The stable dimension, a stable manifold has codimension 1 in this space. But that's very special. This is a separator. It's just like a line in your two-dimensional dynamic system. So this guy could be the boundary of the domain of attraction of the laminar flow, because it's really something that chops the space in two parts, right? So this is great. Now we can say, okay, for any given initial point, I just have to determine if I'm on this side or on this side. If I start on this side, I have to remain on this side for all time, so I can never relaminarize. I will always have to sort of wander back and forth between this guy here, maybe come close, but I never can become fully laminar. If I start on this side, I just become laminar and stay there forever. Okay, so that would pretty much solve the problem. Okay? Will it? So that was the hope, that we can solve the problem. Then we can use it for control theory, because if we know that the phase point is somewhere around here, we push it across this the boundary, it's an external force, and we laminarize, and great, good ideas. Unfortunately, nobody really knows what these guys look like, right? I've drawn them very smooth. This is a two-dimensional thing that looks like a piece of a cylinder. So I drawn a piece of a cylinder. And this is something that's locally smooth, and it's just a hyperplane. But nobody knows what the geometry of these guys is. And we would have to know the geometry to do anything with this idea, right? So my talk today is about computing this guy. This is a two-dimensional manifold. We would like to know this guy as well, but this guy is the dimension is the dimension, the number of Fourier-Chebyshev coefficients in my fluid simulation minus one. So I'm not gonna, I don't know how to do that yet. This guy is two-dimensional. Now, surface in two dimensions, no matter the dimension of the ambient space, we can always cover with curves. And these curves are integral curves of a ODE, which is a discretized Navier-Stokes equation. So what I've set up is, with Genta and a student, is a way to use multiple shooting to compute curves on the manifold. And let me, at this time, ask the chairman. 14? Okay. But this is, I just was told that every talk has to have a proof. Okay. There is a proof in here, but I don't know how much time I want to spend on it. I'll just go briefly through the method. So for those who are familiar with multiple shooting, this is fairly standard. for those who are not, I just want to at least convey how difficult it was. Okay, otherwise it looks so simple, and you're like, oh yeah, why didn't we know about this in 1982? You know, we had auto in the days, you know. Okay, so why is it somewhat difficult? Well, we have the unstable periodic solution. We have a vector in the unstable vector bundle. We can compute this with any desired precision. That's a piece of cake. Then we can start an integration inside the linear approximation to the unstable manifold. And we can integrate forward in time. That's also easy. But this integration is unstable, right? Because this is a chaotic system. So if we integrate long enough, the final point is no longer related to the initial point. So we integrate for a finite time. We put a Poincaré plane of intersection given by some condition on the endpoint that I call G. And then we start a new integration that is a priori. So the initial point of the new integration is a priori just a free variable. And we shoot, this is the second shoot a new plane of intersection. We make sure that every shoot has a short integration time, say one or two times the large eddy turnover time. So there's no the big explosion of error in this integration. And then at the endpoint here, we formulate some scalar condition again. Just has to be a scalar condition, but it can be anything. It can be that the integration time from here to here is one, or that the arc length from here to here is one, or that one of the Fourier-Chebyshev components is zero. Any kind of smooth scalar condition will do. Okay, then we count the equations and the unknowns. Well, the equations, at every point where I need to glue two of these together, I have n equations, n is the number of components in my vector field. This k minus 1 times n gluing points. Then I have k integration times. I do not know a priori how long I have to integrate. And there's epsilon, which determines how far from the periodic orbit I start my integration. Okay, so epsilon has to be a small parameter, otherwise the local approximation does not make sense. And the number of equations is k minus 1 times n for all the gluing, and then k of these scalar conditions where I stop my integrations. Okay, so all said and done, I end up with a set of equations that is underdetermined by 1 degree of freedom, which is good because then I have a Pavlov reaction. Okay, I know that the family of solutions to this problem will be one parameter set of solutions. And I can find it using arc length continuation. That's the same, exactly the same as what we do for continuing periodic orbits or homoclinic orbits or anything. Anytime you compute anything, you continue anything in your computer, you use this setup. Okay, so we can write it as f of x is 0, where f depends on n plus 1 variables and has n components. Okay, so if you look at the auto manual where arc length continuation is explained, that's the equation you see. And what f is depends on what you're computing, right? Okay, so why is this difficult to do in practice? Because if you do arc length continuation, you have to solve a series sequence of linear problems. And the linear problems involve the derivative of that function f. If we compute this derivative, in our case, we get this matrix here. This is a bordered matrix. For every, well, ended block on the diagonal is just a unit matrix. On the subdiagonal, I get these Jacobians. This is the matrix of derivatives of the finite time Navier-Stokes flow. So these are all dense matrices, and they're n by n, where n is the total number of Fourier-Chebyshev coefficients. Okay. So this guy here is big. It's say k times n. K is the number of shooting intervals, and n is the number of Fourier-Chebyshev coefficients. So let's say n is an order of maybe 10,000 at least, otherwise the physicists will laugh at us if we present this, or they walk out. And k, we'll see, will be between 5 and 10 or so. Okay, so this is pretty big, and this border is just of order k. So this is the derivative, say, of all the functions g, right? So this is very small, this is like 5 or 6, and this is maybe half a million, whatever. Okay? So we can't just go and use standard methods to solve these linear problems. Okay, we don't want to use direct methods to solve for this Newton update step, okay, to solve a nonlinear problem. Instead, we have to use iterative methods. And if you know anything about iterative methods, you know that the trouble with those guys is that the spectrum of this matrix has to be right. If the spectrum is right, you can use them out of the box. If it's not right, then you have to use for a preconditioner, and it takes a lot of work. Okay, so think I designed this talk originally for computer scientists, Turing, an algorithm. So I'll skip it for today. So here's a lemma and a proposition. Actually, it doesn't have a proof, but I could talk my way out of it. So the idea is the following. If the spectrum of this matrix is very much clustered, if all the eigenvalues are very close, or almost all eigenvalues are very close, then iterative methods work extremely well. If the spectrum is very scattered, then you're dead. Okay? So what I've managed to prove with some trouble is that this matrix, this big matrix, has almost all eigenvalues equal to 1. Okay? The matrix is, of order k times n, and k minus n times k minus times n minus 1 eigenvalues are 1. And they all come with a multiplicity of k minus 1. So you get a lot of eigenvalues 1, and they all have a lot of generalized eigenvectors associated with them. And this is not so strange. Like, remember, this border is very small. Okay, so if you just squint your eyes and cut off the border, this is pretty much a Jordan normal form of a matrix of all eigenvalues unity. Okay, and then if you add the border, it just changes it a little bit, but not order n. Okay, so knowing the spectrum then, and knowing what the Jordan normal form of this matrix should look like, we can actually prove that the number of GMRES, so GMRES is one particular iterative method for solving linear equations, don't worry about it if you don't want to, is at most 3k minus 1. And this is the bottom line. K was the number of shooting intervals. So this means that if you use my method now to compute orbits on this manifold, I will show you in a moment, then if you triple your resolution in all directions, because that's what physicists have to do to validate the results, anything you find, then the number of degrees of freedom will go up by a factor of 2 to the power 16 or something. The number of iterations you need to do will be the same. Okay, it does not depend on your system size at all. It only depends on the number of shooting intervals. So this is something very special. And if this wouldn't be the case, I wouldn't be here today to show my results. I would be here in 15 years. Because then it would take a few thousand times longer. Okay, so if you want to see the residues, well, this is, okay, for those a bit more knowledgeable in the audience, this would be the outer iteration, these are Newton iterations, these are Kirilov subspace iterations for solving the linear problem inside each Newton iteration. And the theory tells me that at A the residue is zero, and indeed it goes down to machine precision, and here you see that the Newton iterations converge quadratically. So everything works like a charm. Okay, that's the bottom line. If you don't want to remember anything else, okay, remember this. Okay, so let's go back to some math then, or physics, depending how you look at it. So I drew in this schematic picture a circle, that was the periodic orbit, and I drew a piece of a cylinder that I said was the unstable manifold. And here it is, but now computed. These are real data. So the periodic orbit sits here, it's very tiny, you can actually see it. This is again energy input rate, this is energy dissipation rate, and this here is the three-dimensional part of the energy. This is basically if you take the velocity field and you subtract the translationally invariant part, and then you compute the energy, you get this number here. This is an indication of how far you are from laminar flow. So the laminar flow is translationally invariant, so there this number is zero. Okay. So what you see here is a horn coming out of there, and this horn is filled with orbits, and these orbits are, each of these orbits is one continuation step in the orbit continuation program. Okay? And then I've just connected the endpoints with a blue line, so this is the intersection of this manifold with some Poincaré plane of intersection. And it's just a closed curve, so geometrically nothing exciting is happening here. What you see is this is a transition from a very mildly perturbed laminar flow onto more turbulent region, so where the sum of input and dissipation rates are about 6, the flow is fully turbulent. So this models all possible transitions from the near laminar flow to the turbulent flow in one picture. Okay. Very nice. So when did I start to get really excited? Okay, so then I continued, I added more and more intervals and computed longer and longer orbits on this manifold. Okay, we can do this because the computation is stable. Okay, we can do it by simply integrating forward in time. We have to do it by multiple shooting. And what you see then is this is the same picture again, so the same scale. The orbits start to bend around and they come all the way back. Okay, and we start to find orbits that converge back onto the periodic solution. So in this run, this sequence of orbits that I've computed, of orbit segments in the manifold, shows that there is actually a special orbit inside this manifold that is a homoclinic orbit. So this is a cell-type periodic solution in this huge 15,000-dimensional phase space. If you kick it in the right direction, you go along an orbit that's the intersection of the stable and unstable manifolds. Okay, and physicists like to look at time series, so this is the time normalized by the period of that orbit, and you see a very gentle variation, almost sinusoidal, you have a big blip, and then you go back. Okay, so this is the streamwise vorticity, and this is the energy dissipation rate. Okay. So this is a blow-up, this is actual data, it looks like synthesized data, but it's not. This is actually the black curve is the periodic solution. Again, okay, so this is streamwise vorticity, normalized energy dissipation, energy input. If you zoom in and I plot one single orbit on the manifold here, the initial part is colored in red, and this is the direction of the unstable manifold. The final part is colored in blue, and this is the least stable eigenvector. Okay, so the stable manifold is very large, this is the least stable direction, and generically we expect the orbit to approach the periodic orbit, the homoclinic to approach the periodic orbit along the least stable direction. You can also do an error measurement of how close it comes, and it's very extremely small. And the energy measure, it would be something 10 to the power minus 7 or something. Okay, and here we see the same plot again, energy input and dissipation. And now in gray, I've sort of superimposed the quasi-probability density function of turbulence. This is a bit tricky because you can actually leave and you can actually relaminarize, so there's not a stationary random process in any way, but it gives you an impression that this orbit sort of lies in the right ballpark. Okay, so why am I so excited about finding a homoclinic orbit in the shear flow, other than it's just very nice to find something sort of exotic in such a high-dimensional system? Well, the reason is twofold, at least. Okay, so for one thing, it shows that the geometry of these manifolds, so the geometry that I made very simple here. Oops. Okay, so here I drew this guy is a very nice smooth cylinder, and I drew this guy is a very nice smooth hypersurface. Now I know that there's an orbit that starts from this guy, goes all the way into the turbulent regime, and comes back, and has to forcibly lie inside this manifold. So this geometry is very misleading. What is actually happening is that this plane looks like a plane, a part of a homoclinic tangle, and it goes all the way in here. Okay. So our hopes that we have this nice smooth boundary between everything that relaminarizes and everything that stays turbulent, and that we can use it to control the system, is gone, basically. Right? Because if you take a point, you'll probably at any point inside this quasi-attractor, you're close to the boundary between the two, because it's all wound up in there. So the geometry is much more complicated than one would naively expect. And the second reason is that we have to go all the way back to Birkhoff and Smil, if I'm not mistaken. I think Mr. Smil's on the wall over there. I couldn't find Birkhoff. They formulated a theorem that says that if you have a generic dissipative system, you have a periodic solution. Okay, this is a cut for the periodic solution. You have a homoclinic orbit, which is this guy here. Okay. Then, this is misleading. This is a cut, so you have to look at the Poincaré map. The homoclinic orbit will hop from here to here. Okay. Then there's a homoclinic tangle. The manifolds intersect along this curve that winds up on the orbit. And in this section, there's an infinite number of intersection points. And this automatically leads to the existence of an infinite number of unstable periodic solutions that are very close to this homoclinic solution. Okay, so finding evidence, numerical evidence, that there is a homoclinic orbit to this, where shall I find it? Okay, so maybe this guy. So proving that there's an orbit that leaves from this unstable periodic orbit, goes here, comes back and reconnects to itself, means proving that there are infinitely many unstable periodic orbits that do the same, that follow the same course, but they're closed orbits. So this is very important because these are all orbits that give a pathway from the mildly perturbed laminar regime to the turbulent regime and back. 2 minutes? 3 minutes? Something like that? Okay. So importantly, this means that we can sort of make a step forward in our thinking about shear flow. So what we have been talking about so far, mostly, people regard this as a turbulent saddle. So they say this is not an attractor because you know that you can leave it and actually relamellarize and never come back. You cannot call it an attractor. So they have been talking about this as a turbulent saddle, not a very well defined object. We know that there's infinitely many periodic solutions living inside here. And then there's sort of this wall and phase space, and on the other side of the wall you see something else. Okay, now we can sort of have a more inclusive idea of the phase space. There is probably a big turbulent attractor that actually includes orbits that stick around here, and that includes orbits that wander back and forth between these two states, okay, that are close to this homoclinic tangle. So it's a more grown-up idea of what's going on dynamically. Okay, and of course, somewhere in the back of our minds, we would like to use this for control theory, but just in two words, if you're wondering why I keep saying control theory, that's because that's where the money is. Okay, shear flows are very important in industry, and if we find a stable and robust way to force the flow to remain in a laminar regime where the energy dissipation is low, then we can make an awful lot of money. So it's almost obligatory if people publish this kind of work. There's been many publications on this approach to shear flows using dynamical systems in Nature, in Science, and Physical Review Letters. There's always some control somewhere in there, okay, to stress the future promise. So just to think, what would you have to think about? Well, suppose that so suppose you're looking at the flow. Then this the green line is just the homoclinic orbit. That this is sort of like a cliche, like a form, shape, something that you can impose on the flow. If you get a big overshoot, you might go back and nearly relaminarize or completely relaminarize. So we hope that this special solution gives us a way to analyze the flow in real time and pick up signals that predict laminarization. But that's a long-term plan. But for now, it's just mathematically exciting.